For 2 months now, the New York Police Department has been struggling to recover from the damage caused by this summer's chokehold death of a Staten Island man in police custody. The case of Eric Garner has caused critics to challenge the broken window strategy that has guided the NYPD for decades. Little is known about the officer at the center of the case, apart from grainy pictures and a cell phone video. But WNYC's Robert Lewis has been examining the officer's arrest record and found him to be the embodiment of the department's controversial approach to policing.
I was washing clothes with my father and my girlfriend.
Donovan Taylor is standing outside a laundromat on Forest Avenue in Staten Island, next door to a dollar store and an abandoned gas station. 2 years ago, he watched from inside as plainclothes cops held his father against the window and searched him. Taylor was 17 at the time. He ran outside and asked what was going on. 1 second, an officer was ordering him to stand back. The next, he was swarmed by four cops.
I'm scared. That's what happened. I was scared. And I'm not trying to fight back. It's too many, though.
It was busting his head like this on the floor, just banging it.
That's his girlfriend, Shaquasia Albright. She was pregnant at the time, screaming at the cops to leave him alone.
Y'all just doing this stuff because he was standing there asking what's going on? That's messed up.
The arresting officer was Daniel Pantaleo, the guy who applied a chokehold to Eric Garner while arresting him for selling loose cigarettes in July. There was widespread outrage after a cell phone video emerged of that fatal encounter.
I'm minding my business. Please just leave me alone.
The video shows Garner trying to back away from officers who want to handcuff him. But five cops pounce. Pantaleo grabs Garner around the neck from behind.
I can't breathe.
The medical examiner ruled the death a homicide, caused in part by the chokehold. The case has inflamed old passions over police tactics in minority communities and the treatment of African-American men, all over the illegal sale of loose cigarettes. But law enforcement experts say it shouldn't come as a shock when a minor arrest turns into a major tragedy. For decades, the NYPD has embraced the broken windows theory of policing, in which low-level arrests prevent more serious crime, with zero tolerance for even the most minor violations.
This is what the NYPD does.
Professor John Eterno runs the Graduate Criminal Justice Program at Molloy College.
This is their style of policing, at least for the last 12 years. And most officers that are on the NYPD, this is the style of policing that they're familiar with. They know nothing else.
But any arrest can turn violent, and violence almost never ends well for the person being arrested. The sad fact is, except for the tragic outcome, the arrest of Eric Garner was a routine affair for Officer Daniel Pantaleo. Far from being a rogue cop, records show Pantaleo's career is the very definition of broken windows policing, the hallmark of the 21st century NYPD. Pantaleo is listed as the arresting officer in 259 criminal court cases since he came on the force in 2007, among the most active cops on Staten Island in that period. Only 24 were for felonies, according to a WNYC analysis of state court records. Almost all of the arrests were in low-income, mostly minority neighborhoods on Staten Island's North Shore, where Pantaleo worked in a particularly aggressive plainclothes unit dedicated to high-crime areas.
It's clear that he's policing by the numbers.
Eterno is a former NYPD captain who has criticized the department's emphasis on statistics. He flipped through the records of Pantaleo's arrests on a recent afternoon in his office on Long Island.
Criminal possession of a controlled substance, unlicensed operation of a vehicle. Again, not a major thing, but it is something. Criminal trespass, once again, we see a lot of those. Possession of marijuana, we see a number of those in here. There are some weapon arrests, which is very good. I did see a few robbery, but very, very limited.
John DiCarlo, an associate professor of criminal justice at John Jay College, also reviewed the records. He says there are no red flags that indicate a pattern of excessive use of force. That tells him that what happened on that street on Staten Island was a spontaneous occurrence, one of the random hazards of police work.
The police officer sometimes could lose control of a situation very easily. Looking at an officer's background would not explain something that happened as spontaneously as the Garner case seems to have happened.
Eterno says broken windows policing does explain what happened after the chokehold and contributed to Garner's death.
Where the problem, I think, lies is their non-reaction to Mr. Garner's pleas for help. they didn't see him as a person anymore. Once he was cuffed, it was, okay, my job's done, I have my number, let's move on.
Two-thirds of Pantaleo's cases that made it to court ended up getting dismissed, or with the person pleading guilty to a disorderly conduct violation, just slightly more serious than a speeding ticket. These are people who feel they were arrested and run through the system for no good reason, and see the cops almost as an occupying force.
They always stop, like, black people around here in this neighborhood.
It's a Friday morning, and Terrell Thompson is sitting outside his apartment in Port Richmond, one of the rougher areas in Staten Island, with his neighbors, other young black men, who all have their own stories about being arrested. Thompson was also arrested by Pantaleo last spring. He took a reporter to the block where he and a couple of friends that day were pushing an old boiler in a shopping cart, taking it to the local scrapyard.
We seen a cop car stop, like, right here, and then they made a U-turn.
They had caught the attention of Pantaleo and a group of other cops who thought the metal might be stolen.
I told him, like, the property is not stolen, because I got it from my girlfriend's mom's house. And then, like, mad cops came after that.
They arrested him anyway, and he wound up in criminal court on charges of obstructing traffic and resisting arrest. Thompson agreed to do 3 days of community service and stay out of trouble for 6 months to get his case dismissed. Christopher Pashoda is in charge of Legal Aid Staten Island office, overseeing criminal defense for people like Thompson, who can't afford to hire their own attorney. The office keeps files on about 200 problem cops, officers who use excessive force or who have credibility issues. And Pantaleo wasn't one of them.
My staff attorneys were unaware of who this officer was at the time of Eric Garner's death.
Pantaleo has been sued twice for civil rights violations, but court filings show other cops in his precinct have been sued far more frequently. Court records show Pantaleo was also the subject of civilian complaints and has come under scrutiny from NYPD investigators, but such disciplinary records are confidential. Pantaleo's attorney declined an interview request. The Patrolman's Benevolent Association also refused to comment. A video posted on the union's website shortly after Garner's death shows union president Patrick Lynch defending Pantaleo.
His reputation is an active, good, solid police officer.
Just miles away from the streets he policed, a landscaper was working on one of the well-manicured lawns in Pantaleo's neighborhood of Eltingville. Pantaleo didn't respond to an interview request. I couldn't even knock on the door without drawing the attention of a squad car across the street. The home has been under 24-hour police guard since Garner's death. The cop keeping watch says no one is home nor will be.
I'm only here for one day. As far as I know, there's nobody in this house.
Police Commissioner William Bratton has pledged to retrain NYPD officers on the use of force. He also plans to stick with the aggressive policing of low-level crimes. A grand jury meets this month to consider charges against Pantaleo. For WNYC, I'm Robert Lewis.
The decision by a Staten Island grand jury not to file charges against the police officer in the Eric Garner case has widened the rift between the NYPD and communities of color. Police Commissioner Bill Bratton had promised to improve relations through more training and getting rid of problem cops. But a closer look at the NYPD's discipline practice reveals that the department does not live up to the standards set by its pioneering use of computer statistics to fight crime. As WNYC's Robert Lewis found in a 3-month investigation, there are dozens of cops with red flags on their record who are still on the street.
Darvell Elliott was arrested because he matched the description of someone who robbed a man's iPod and cell phone. At least that's what the cops told him on that August night in Brownsville back in 2010. He says he was in handcuffs when the world went black. He came to...
in a hospital. Brookdale Hospital. Face stuck to the sheet. Like Velcro.
Photos show his face covered with blood-soaked bandages. The charges, robbery and possession of stolen property, were ultimately dismissed. Elliot says they simply grabbed the wrong guy, and he filed a lawsuit. The city agreed to pay him $20,000 to settle. The arresting officer named in the lawsuit is a Brooklyn cop, Donald Sadawi.
He think we the danger, but you're the danger. Like, you're supposed to protect and serve us. We're not supposed to be scared of you. We're supposed to be safe around you.
But time and again, suspects haven't been safe around Sadawi. Records show he's been accused of excessive force in multiple lawsuits during the 6 years he's been making arrests, yet he continues to make them. And it's not just him. WNYC easily found a dozen other cops who appear to use force more often than most and who have been the subject of numerous lawsuits. Records also show a relatively small number of cops generate the most civilian complaints, and the department has often ignored recommendations on how to discipline the worst, all of which calls into question just how seriously the NYPD polices its own.
I think there's been a really systematic failure of accountability on the part of the NYPD.
Samuel Walker is a retired criminal justice professor from the University of Nebraska who recently served as an expert witness in the Stop and Frisk trial. He says the department does have multiple personnel databases that keep information on things like civilian complaints and disciplinary histories for its 35,000 officers. The department also monitors cops who are accused of excessive force. But Walker says it's not enough. He says the NYPD puts a lot of energy and resources into spotting crime trends. It should do the same for problem cops.
If you could devise a system to identify them and to identify them early, you could prevent a lot of these inappropriate actions out there on the street.
And you could save at least some of the more than $100 million a year the city spends to settle lawsuits against the NYPD. Disciplinary files in New York State are confidential, but there are public records that show the department has allowed cops with numerous red flags to stay on the street. That's certainly the case with Donald Sadawi. On one arrest, he wasn't even allowed to testify in court.
I'm at the light, the three officers at the light. They looked, I looked at them. I'm not knowing any cops, but when I seen them, whoo, whoo, I'm like, damn, that's the cops. They coming back this way.
This was in July 2012, when Sadawi pulled over Dennis Graves in Crown Heights. Minutes later, Graves was in handcuffs. Sadawi claimed he saw drugs in the cup holder, but Graves said the cops found the drugs in the underwear of a passenger. He said he had no idea the passenger was carrying. It was his word against Sadawi. Normally, that's a losing situation, but not in this case.
My lawyer, he was like, I think they're going to dismiss it because the officer did something wrong.
Turns out, prosecutors decided Sadawi wasn't a credible witness because he gave conflicting testimony in an unrelated case. The charges against Graves were dismissed. Now he has a lawsuit pending in federal court. It's one of at least 10 filed against Sadawi in a little more than 2 years.
If there are 10 lawsuits, there's something wrong here. And if this person has not been reprimanded and controlled, there's something wrong.
Candace McCoy is a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. The NYPD and the Officers Union declined to answer questions about Sadawi's record, and he didn't return a message left at the 73rd Precinct where he works.
10 lawsuits is too much. The question is, what is the cutoff? What is the exact number beyond which you take this person off the street?
Experts agree there's no simple answer to that question. A lot of misconduct never results in a lawsuit. On the flip side, lawsuits often name several officers, including some who might have played a minor role in an incident. So departments around the country often look for combinations of indicators to spot patterns of questionable behavior. Many, for example, also look at cops who regularly charge people with resisting arrest. Again, police accountability expert Walker.
There's a widespread pattern in American policing where resisting arrest charges are used to sort of cover, and that phrase is used, the officer's use of force. Why did the officer use force? Well, the person was resisting arrest.
WNYC's analysis of criminal court records shows that less than 2% of police officers in the NYPD have 10 or more resisting arrest cases since 2009. Sadawi has more than 20. Robert Kane is a professor and director of the Criminology and Justice Studies program at Drexel University. He spent years studying officer misconduct in the NYPD. He says historically, the department has done more to crack down on corrupt cops than abusive ones. He says cops like Sadawi are on the street because the NYPD wants them there.
I would only expect that officer to be taken off the street if the organization didn't value the aggressive behavior in which that officer typically engages.
The problem with aggressive policing policies, he says, is that they can lead to outright aggression in individual cops.
If some officers get videotaped or their cases end up in court or they generate a complaint by people on the street, I wouldn't call them bad apples per se. I would say that perhaps they've just taken this a little bit too far.
In New York City, citizen complaints go to the Civilian Complaint Review Board. Attorney Richard Emery is the chairman. He says complaints are an important indicator.
It may be that some complaints do not have a basis, and they are put out there by people who are simply lying or making them up. But it's also the case that many people who could complain legitimately don't.
CCRB records show that 40% of the 35,000 officers on the force today have never been the subject of a citizen complaint. Another 20% have only one. Yet about 1,000 cops have 10 or more complaints. One has been able to rack up 51. The name of that officer is confidential, as are the names of any officer who is the target of a CCRB complaint.
If an officer has a pattern of a lot of complaints, let alone substantiated complaints, that officer is certainly worth watching and even warning and certainly retraining.
Yet Emery says that at least until now, the department hasn't seemed too interested in using the board's trove of records to spot problem officers.
They've had access to it, but they've never asked. I mean, the problem is that in the past, the New York City Police Department has not viewed the CCRB as anything but an irritant.
The NYPD did not respond to multiple requests for an interview for this story. Police Commissioner William Bratton has started a massive department-wide retraining on the use of force and spoken out about the need to get rid of bad cops.
There are some officers in the department, unfortunately, who should not be here. They're brutal, they're corrupt, and we'll work very aggressively to deal with that.
As for Sadawi, an 11th lawsuit was filed against him just last month. For WNYC, I'm Robert Lewis.
The city's Civilian Complaint Review Board was created more than two decades ago to investigate allegations of police abuse. The independent agency handles 5,000 complaints a year about everyday interactions with police that fuel the anger in a case like the death of Eric Garner. Throughout its history, the CCRB has been criticized as a toothless watchdog whose recommendations are routinely ignored by the NYPD. We don't know much about those cases because individual discipline records are confidential. But WNYC's Robert Lewis has obtained the records from a 2013 investigation into a brutality complaint in Queens that gives us an unprecedented look into the CCRB process and its apparent failures. He filed this report.
Today is April 18, 2013, and the time is now 11:45 a.m.
Investigator Alexander Lai is looking into a complaint by a man named Warren Diggs, who says cops beat him up in South Jamaica nearly 2 years ago after they chased him for riding his bike on the sidewalk near his home and arrested him for marijuana possession.
So can you describe one of them for me?
All right, James Frascato is the only one that I have.
The Civilian Complaint Review Board's investigative file on Officer James Frascatori and five other cops swelled to 800 pages and took a year to compile. Lai conducted 8 hours of interviews and recorded them all. Those files and recordings, obtained by WNYC from records in an unrelated court case, offer a rare glimpse into an agency frequently criticized for its ineffectiveness. The record is at once both impressive and also evidence of why the agency's performance rarely results in real discipline for cops.
It has stumbled along in mediocrity for 20 years.
Richard Emery is the CCRB chairman. He says he wants to reform the agency because too often it has acquiesced to police misconduct.
Most cases, if there's no videotape or if there are no witnesses or if there's no real corroboration of any reliable sort, are he said, she said cases.
In general, investigators are young, recent college grads with no investigative experience. Starting salary is $36,000. Training is about 3 weeks. And then they are supervised by more experienced investigators and lawyers. Frascatori bounced around three different police departments in 4 years in Florida before landing at the NYPD in 2011. The file shows this was one of five civilian complaints filed against him in 7 months. That's more than 90% of officers working today have received in their entire careers. Under questioning, Frascatori said he saw Diggs buy marijuana from another man on a bike, and the cops gave chase. But the other officers riding in the same marked van as Frascatori couldn't confirm a drug deal. They say they followed Diggs because he was riding his bike on the sidewalk, which is technically illegal. Officer Tim Costello says he yelled out the window for Diggs to stop.
Where was he when you first gave him that?
He's on the sidewalk, approaching his house.
Diggs says the three cops ran up his driveway and demanded to see his ID. He says he told them it was inside and started to go get it. And he says they grabbed him, punched and kicked him, and then used pepper spray. The cops found two small bags of pot on him. His girlfriend, Hines, told investigators she came outside during the scuffle.
They had him on the ground, and they were essentially beating him, kicking, kneeing, and punching him.
Cops say they told Diggs not to go inside because there could have been a weapon in there. They say he ignored them. Officer Alex Lombardozzi.
Do you ever have to strike him in any manner, punch or kick him?
I did not, no. I don't recall if the other officers might have.
Hines and Diggs filed a complaint that alleges use of excessive force, abuse of authority, and making false statements. And the he said, she said Frascatore case might have gone away quietly, except for one thing. When Hines, the girlfriend, walked outside, she did what so many people do these days. She started recording on her phone. It's just audio, no video. It starts after Diggs has been pepper sprayed and is being handcuffed.
So you're saying that all of this I just saw was because he was riding on a sidewalk?
No, no. All this you just saw is because he started fighting us. When we asked for ID, that's why.
Okay.
I stopped in the house so you grabbed
wait,
me.
Wait. Come here.
You punched me in my face with me. I resisted. Yeah, somebody tried to pull you out your house. What the you gonna do?
Here's Officer Frascatore.
Ask me for your ID.
I said it's inside.
Listen, I gotta go and get it.
It's over with. Hines asks the officers for their identification. Officer Costello politely complies. Here's her interaction with Frascatore.
I'm gonna need everybody's, since you said last name and badge number, please.
Sorry?
I'm gonna need everybody's last name and badge number.
Okay, yeah, we'll get to you when we're done doing our job. Thank you. Very much.
Here's how he testified about that encounter.
Had she asked you for your name or shield?
Cool.
And then things get out of hand. As cops took Diggs to their vehicle, Hines had one of her kids take the bicycle inside. But Frascatore wanted it for evidence. In the criminal complaint, Frascatore swore that Hines cursed at him and said she was taking the bike inside. He later tells an investigator about a tug of war over the bike with Hines outside the house.
Yeah, I grabbed the bike.
Okay. Tell me about that, what happened.
I grabbed the bike and she continued to pull into the house.
But none of that is backed up by the audio recording.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
Where's the bicycle that was out here?
It's my bike. I need that bicycle.
Thank you.
It's my bike.
It's evidence.
It's his bike.
It's evidence or I'm coming in the house.
Listen.
All three cops are involved in getting the bike back. It's unclear who says what. They all testify that they don't recognize any of the voices, including their own.
Bring the bike outside.
Could you back up a little bit, please?
No.
I feel threatened.
About to come That's fine.
I'm about to come in your house. I'm sorry, don't.
And take the bike.
You're going to bring the bike out
this
in a minute.
If this is what you want your kids to witness, that's fine. I'm going to arrest you and take the bike if you do not get out of my way and hand me the bicycle.
Go get the bike, ma'am.
If you can back up, please,
go get the bike, ma'am.
I will get the bike.
You're going to get the bike.
But it's too late.
Are you touching me?
Are you going to go to jail?
Are you touching me, too?
You're going to go to jail.
I can't get the bike if you're holding me.
Get the bike right now.
Let go of me. Don't come in my house. Don't come in my house. Let go of me. Let me get the bike.
Frascatore arrests Hines, charges her with a felony for tampering with evidence, also obstructing governmental administration and resisting arrest. Her children, heard in the background, are 8 and 11.
He has the bike now. What's the problem?
Because you're going to jail.
I'm going to jail for what?
Because you don't listen. That's why.
Thank you.
The criminal charges against both Diggs and Hines were ultimately dismissed. Thanks to the tape, the CCRB recommended disciplining Frascatore for not giving his name and shield number to Hines when she asked. They referred other inconsistencies in his testimony to the NYPD's Internal Affairs Bureau.
Okay, is there anything else to ask?
No.
Okay, so time is now 12:31 p.m. This interview is now concluded.
It's been 18 months since the complaint was filed. In an interview with WNYC, Hines says she doesn't feel that anything positive came about as a result. She's planning to sue the city.
If you want to have somebody who will listen to you, so you can tell your story, absolutely. They were fantastic with that. But other than that, it was a waste of time.
Emery became CCRB chairman earlier this year. He says he wants to bring in attorneys earlier in investigations, speed up cases, and do more with the agency's trove of complaint data. He says reform will help the NYPD take the CCRB more seriously. It's unclear what discipline, if any, Frescatore ultimately faced from the NYPD. He didn't respond to an interview request. His union lawyer declined to talk on his behalf, and the NYPD wouldn't answer even basic questions about his current rank or assignment. For WNYC, I'm Robert Lewis.
NYPD officers appear to be far more likely to file resisting arrest charges against black suspects than white suspects, with dramatic differences in some parts of the city. That's the conclusion of a new analysis by WNYC's data news team. Robert Lewis reports.
Law enforcement experts say resisting arrest charges are a strong indicator that an arrest went bad and a cop had to use force. So with the death of Eric Garner over the summer during an arrest for selling loose cigarettes, WNYC's data news team analyzed court records to look at who gets charged with resisting arrest. Noah Veltman from Data News explains.
We looked at some of the most commonly charged crimes in New York City and found a consistent racial disparity. If you look at low-level drug possession cases, for example, a black defendant is almost twice as likely as a white defendant to get a resisting arrest charge.
The disparity is even greater on Staten Island, with blacks almost 2.5 times more likely to be accused of resisting arrest. Noel Leader, a former NYPD sergeant and co-founder of the group 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care, blames the disparity on the illegal use of stop and frisk.
This unnecessary contact between communities of color and law enforcement has created a very high level of hostility and anger.
But Seymour James, head of the Legal Aid Society, says the numbers don't necessarily reflect aggressive actions by people getting arrested. Instead, it could be a sign that police are more aggressive in minority communities.
I think it's reflective of the fact that the police are physically abusive towards people of color and treat them with less respect than whites who were arrested.
The NYPD did not respond to an interview request. For WNYC, I'm Robert Lewis.